Hello and welcome to this Do Something for Nothing podcast takeover for The Conduit. My name is Joshua Coombs and I'm going to be your co-host alongside my friend and Conduit member, Dr. Ebony Escalona. For this series, we've interviewed some really interesting people who are doing things outside of the box to benefit their communities and our planet. For a bit of context on Do Something for Nothing and how it began, in 2015, I was working as a hairdresser in a salon in London. I started going out and offering free haircuts to men and women who were experiencing homelessness and living on the street. This grew into a movement of other people getting involved with their skills and their time to positively affect the lives of people around them. The conversations we've had really embody this spirit, so we're excited to share them with you and we hope you enjoy it. Thank you.
Just an ordinary dad and estate agent from Worthing? I think not. Phil Heckles, aka Hercule Van Wolfwinkle, gave us all a laugh over lockdown with his rubbish pet portraits. But behind the hilariously captioned artwork is a powerful conduit in raising awareness and funds for homelessness charities, Turning Tides and Street Vet. This social media sensation was crowned the 2022 Just Giving Creative Fundraiser of the Year. And in this episode, we explore how artistic humour really can do a lot, not just something, for nothing.
Well, I'm mighty happy to have you in the building, Phil.
Thanks for having me.
Very, very, very happy. And can we just quickly say a huge congratulations because you've just been crowned Creative Fundraiser of the Year at the Just Giving Awards, which is just like absolutely epic.
Thank you. It was an overwhelming evening. And I didn't think I was going to win. And we got an email around from Just Giving a couple of days beforehand saying, like, think about what you might say if you win. And I was like, I don't need to think about that. Genuinely didn't. Mm-hmm. And then I went up and did a little speech. And then I realized, like, yesterday night when I got home that the two people I forgot to thank were my wife, Ashley, and my son, Sam. So I had to thank them on Facebook yesterday and now I'm off the naughty step. So, but yeah, no, it was an amazing night. It was such a good night. Meeting like people that are just doing some good, which is why it's great to come and meet Josh and speak to you and do all that.
Well, cheers, Phil. And like, yeah, real pleasure to have you on, mate. Like, yeah, just to sort of obviously to go backwards through, like, why you, for people listening, maybe hearing about your work for the first time, like, why were you receiving this award the other night? Like, what was that for? As in, like, sort of just your work and you know, how that's kind of, led you to, like, you know, where you're at now with all of it, where it started and what it's about?
Well, I call them rubbish. Some people call them stupid. Other people call them endearing. But I draw portraits of people's pets. And it started in lockdown 2020. So the end of the summer holidays, and I was drawing at home with my then six-year-old son, and I drew this picture of our dog, and it was crap, but it made us laugh. And so I thought, I'll stick it on Facebook, and I stuck it on Facebook with this jokey comment, pet portraits are for sale and come and place your orders. But it only went out to, like, it was just my Facebook page, it went out to my mates. And really long story short, it basically went viral. And so within a matter of weeks, I had like thousands of people that all wanted portraits. And so that's where the fundraising idea came from. So it didn't, none of this was like me sitting down and going, I'm going to raise some money. How can I do that? Oh, well, it was for the first, I don't know, like 2 or 3 weeks, it was just all a laugh. Mm-hmm. That's all it was. And then, it came from a conversation with a mate who wanted to buy the original portrait that I'd done. And nobody wanted the originals up until him. Now everybody wants them, but at that point, no one wanted one. And he was like, I want it. I want to stick it on my wall. And I was like, mate, it's crap. Like, why do you want this picture of your dog? And anyway, again, long story short, in the back and forth between him wanting to give me some money, I said, just give it to Turning Tides, who are our local homelessness charity. And that's where the idea was born. And the rest, they say, is kind of history. Well, it's not history because it's still going on. So
no, it's evolving.
It's got me to the present, I guess. Yeah.
But I want to say thank you because lockdown for everyone was incredibly tough. There were obviously moments of joy, but it was so tough. And to have to stumble across you on my feed, it's like spitting out tea moments. It's so funny. It gives you such light relief. But it's, for me, it's not just the artistry, Phil. It's the captions.
Well,
the captions are just incredible.
I'm glad you say that because they're the hardest bit. Like the write-ups and everything, they're by far and away the hardest bit. Like the drawings are easy, but the write-ups and stuff, that's the hardest bit. So I'm glad when people say they like the captions. It's like a, gives me a little warm glow inside because that's what I spend all my time doing.
Yeah, that's a little bit. I mean, I can imagine, first of all, as well, the drawing itself, right? Because you ended up with thousands of people. And did you start like fulfilling all those requests as best you could? Like, how did that look at the beginning?
At the very beginning, that, yeah, it was, because it was, for the first, again, like the timeline's sketchy now, like so much has happened, but it was like, I think for the first couple of weeks, it was just all been done on my own personal Facebook page to my mates. But they were sharing it. So I was getting more and more requests from people I didn't know, which is why I then sort of moved it away from my personal page and onto the Pet Portraits by Hercule platform. So at first, it was kind of like I had a waiting list of maybe 100. And I thought, I could get through these. Like, I could get through these. And then it got to a point where it was like, very quickly, like 200, 300, 400, 500, 600, and then into the thousands. And then it was, again, that was a point in which there's been loads of moments where I nearly just stopped. But that was one moment where I was, because the fundraising had started by this point, and I had kind of naively, I guess, looking back on it, thought I can work my way through these hundreds of pictures. Then it got into the thousands, and I panicked because I thought what I was really worried about was that people were then donating with the expectation of getting a portrait. And whilst I had made it quite clear that you weren't definitely going to get one, it was just something that kind of worried me. And then I think it was my other half, but someone said to me, look, Phil, what are you worrying about? Because it's a special kind of person that donates, say, 10 quid to a homelessness charity, even if they're expecting a portrait, and then kicks off if they don't get it. Like, what's the worst that's happened? Like, a charity's got 10 quid and they haven't got a portrait. But people were donating like £100, £200. Say that was something that really kind of played on my mind. So I nearly just stopped. And then kind of, again, it's sort of like none of this has been planned. But then thankfully, just as all of that was going on, the first bit of media attention came in, and then it just exploded so big that it was then easy for me to say it's obvious it's a lottery, because I've got 50,000 people that now want a portrait. So, you know, and again, that actually has been the thing that now drives the donations, because it is a lottery. So people buy their lottery ticket.
Yeah. And it goes to charity.
Yeah.
So we're all here connected through homelessness. In fact, Street Vet is what connects us all, and why we're all kind of here today. Housing and homelessness is a theme for you, Phil, because your professional background is as an estate agent. And then now, you know, you're this huge advocate for homelessness. So what is that connection? You could have picked 1,000 charities. You could have not picked a charity at all. Why turning tides, and why is homelessness part of this incredible, humorous journey?
Do you know what? There's no romantic tale. And I'd, you know, in a way, I'd love there to be this romantic tale that I once found myself homeless and I've, you know, kind of turned it, you know, somebody helped me and I'm repaying the debt. None of that at all. It is just simply that. The two reasons for me with homelessness, and actually just to go back further, the initial thing of the turning tides thing, as I mentioned earlier, was actually a throwaway thing. No thought went into it. It was a back and forth between me and a mate, and I went, give some money to Turning Tides. So there wasn't any real thought that I'm going to embark on this huge, great, big fundraising campaign. Who am I supporting? The reason Turning Tides was my throwaway thing was that they're a charity that were the front of my mind, because we donate to them a lot as a family, and always have done. Actually, way back before they were Turning Tides, they were known as Worthing Church's homeless projects, and we used to donate to them then. So it was, for me, the reason we support Turning Tides as a family, long before all of this went on, is that, like we all of us have needed or will need the help of other people in our lives. And that might not be anything more than somebody just coming around to help you jumpstart your car, or like putting you up for a couple of days because you've had a flat rental fall through, or whatever it might be. But all of us will need the help of other people at some point. And I think if, as humans and communities and over wider societies, we can't look at the most vulnerable people within those societies, the people that literally have nothing and want to help them, then what does that say about where the help might come from when we might need it? So for me, it's simply a case of supporting a group of people that I see as some of the most vulnerable people in our societies. And then I think it goes beyond that, because I also think that the narrative of homelessness is skewed, and I think we'd all agree on that. I've got no doubt at all that if I was fundraising for another cause, I would have raised an awful lot more money than I have. Mm-hmm. And that's not me trying to be controversial or anything like that. But I think the narrative of homelessness, we've all seen the Facebook post, right? I went to town today and I couldn't believe the amount of homeless people I saw. But the narrative of that is, I couldn't believe the amount of homeless people I saw, and it ruined my trip to Primark.
Right.
Not that we've got to help these people. And so again, it was about trying to, well, actually, again, it wasn't about trying to do anything, because it was all an accident. But what's been great as the project's gone on is being able to then kind of bring a little bit of awareness to the issues of homelessness.
Yeah, and in doing so, it's, like you said, it's kind of hopefully removing this veil of what it looks like sometimes from the outside. And, you know, for anyone listening to this, I think your example, you know, to sort of bring that home more recently for me is, you know, that really does exist. I mean, of course, a lot of people are compassionate about this issue. Of course, people want to help out. But there is sometimes this life-size stigma in between, like the quote-unquote us and them. And it does involve, obviously, like some surface-level issues that are important to confront and have empathy for. Like if you're interacting with someone who's got like heavy substance abuse issues, mental health issues, like the things that precede sometimes living out in the elements on the street, that kind of survival mode of just being out there each night trying to find somewhere to sleep. It's not going to be this kind of always this really beautiful interaction. You're obviously meeting people who are experiencing perhaps lots of difficulties and challenges right now, maybe past traumas that they're like really yet to work through, and maybe you know that can exist kind of in a really cyclical way each day for people, just the struggle. So it's almost like it is a complex issue, you know, and trying to find ways to sort of change that narrative, I'm sure, is part of your work now. Just one example on what you were saying. Like, I remember the first time I went to San Francisco in America, and, you know, I do lots of projects working in different places with people living on the street. And that's obviously like a real difficult spot in America where you've got this contrast of Silicon Valley and like crazy inflated rent prices. Like, no one could live in the city anymore, like ordinary working people, and so much visible homelessness, and especially in an area called Tenderloin, which is downtown San Francisco. And when you're booking hotels, and people can do this as a research right now if they can be bothered on Google, but if you go on any of these hotel websites, the comments on every place downtown are, love it, San Francisco, but there's so many homeless people, and there's so many people you're tripping over them as you leave the door. And there's a lot of negativity as well, because it's ruined people's trip.
Yeah.
And it's just so interesting, because what you get is you get these places where they're trying their best to try and sweep this thing under the rug, but you're seeing this kind of byproduct of this place that, you know, lives in a, you know, kind of a, you know, people live within this city, and there's a contrast, and it's hard for people to know what to do with it. And sometimes it is literally looked upon as mess to tidy up. Mm. So, you know, those opinions do exist. In your work kind of with this, since you've, you know, started Pet Portraits, and you've obviously, you know, turning tides, you've been supporting them, have you seen like some positive changes through the work that you've done and kind of a way this is viewed, like homelessness? Or if not, like, is there kind of, do you see those challenges, and do you see kind of like ways around them for you and like your work with this?
I think it's definitely brought a conversation that people who perhaps wouldn't have had that conversation are now able to have. But I think the other thing that's kind of surprised me so much with it is that we've had people donating from all over the world to this, what is actually, I don't mean this in a disparaging way, but like a tiny little charity in like Sussex. They don't even go beyond our local county, you know? And yeah, they are the largest homelessness charity in Sussex, but it's a really small area. And so to have got people kind of donating to that from like California or France or Belgium is on the one hand amazing. But then on the other hand, you then suddenly realize that actually my audience is not really our captive audience that is, from a longevity point of view, going to do Turning Tides a world of good. And so, you know, again, one of the things with like pet portraits is that the audience is huge. But actually, in terms of like Worthing and kind of where we're based and where the charities are based, there's been very little press about it. Mm. Very few people really, I don't think, even know what I'm doing or what it's about. And so actually, like I say, the fundraising is one thing, but what I'm always really pleased about is when we can get stuff going on locally, because this, what I'm doing is not going to last forever. And so for me, it's also about like what kind of, how much attention can we turn to Turning Tide so that they have a lasting legacy of people that are going to be still donating to Turning Tides in 30 years' time as their Christmas charity because they've done it this year because of me. And so that's one of the problems that we've got is actually it's almost the reach of it is almost outstrips the charity. I don't know if I've described that so in terms of like the impact that it's had on Turning Tides, it's really probably quite crudely just been a financial one. More than
which is not a
than
bad
anything
thing.
But if we can try to sort of it's again, you know, one of the things that's in my mind and what we're looking to do is to try to get more involved in the charities, which I've now kind of got a bit more time to do, is to try to then be able to actually campaign a little bit more and try to get their message out there a little bit more in terms of what they do, and I think that might hopefully kind of get more local people involved with them.
When you said, oh, this is not going to last forever, I could actually say it probably could, because you're using the conduit of humour, which just is needed. And I think what's been incredible when I've helped you on a couple of lives is how that humour provides a window. Because people come to you not because of what you do fundraising. They come because it makes them feel funny. They can share it. Have you seen what he's done today? And that humour is so powerful. Like, yeah, do you want to talk on that? Because as Joshua's very eloquently described, homelessness is a very emotive, depressing thing. And you're actually providing this lens with humour that makes it accessible to almost anyone.
Yeah, I mean, I think the humour side of it is what kind of obviously brings a lot of people to it, and whether that's actually like the written humor or the pictures, I mean the pictures are kind of like the instantly accessible thing, and I think actually it's maybe the write-ups that keep people around, because you know, like you look at a few rubbish pet portraits and after the fourth or fifth it's a bit like, oh, I've seen that before, but hopefully it's the little write-ups that kind of people will still get bored of it eventually, I'm sure of that. Yeah, once you've then got people engaged with that side of it, then hopefully they start to dig a little bit deeper and find out a little bit more about what I'm doing. And that is a kind of a bit of a tightrope that you walk, because sort of sadly, when I do my fundraising updates and things, they're always the posts that when you look on your Google, you know, your little insights, they're always the ones where the most people unfollow you and all of that kind of thing. And so what I've kind of like, I say it's what I've kind of learned to do is to sort of tread that tightrope of kind of keeping an audience in front of you. Mm-hmm. And then those reminders, you know, and it's great when you kind of then put those reminders out there that you then see the new audience that's come to it who go, I didn't realize you were doing this. Mm-hmm. And suddenly you're able to then kind of have that conversation all over again, you know? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think does the humor, will the humor keep people there forever? I don't know. I just do what I do, and you know, but that's my starting point. Every single post, my starting point is, will this make someone smile? It's nothing to do with, is this going to generate £100 worth of donations, or is it going to gain me 100 more likes, or, you know, 1,000 new followers? Yeah. Every time I do something, it's just, will this just make someone smile? Mm. Because that's how it started, right? And if you don't change that, then hopefully people keep coming to it.
Yeah, there's all kinds of ways to captivate people, and I just think that element of the work you do is really, really important. I think, honestly, I think we live in a time where people are experiencing, ordinary people are experiencing kind of so much of perhaps their own struggle in their own life. So, you know, if you've got some like charity coming along with this kind of like old school way of putting a message out there, which might have worked for some period of time, but, you know, it's kind of, I guess it reminds people of the suffering A, they might already be experiencing, or if you are living quite an affluent life and maybe you've got a lot of success materially speaking, it might remind you of the other world that exists within your city that perhaps you don't want to pay much attention to, because, you know, maybe you're not consciously in that place to be able to do so. So things like humor, things like kind of like different ways you can open the door to get somebody's attention, to just also just have, that's an important part of life anyway, to just have that interaction of like things you see each day that make you smile, but then to be able to kind of look at that and see, oh, actually, yeah, if I do buy one of these, it's cool, because it goes to to a place where it's going to support people. And I do really feel that. I feel that it's so hopeful in that kind of respect, that there's so many people who are realizing that maybe what altruism or charity looked like for a long time in that sector, it's like, okay, of course those organizations are really important, they do amazing work, but there's other avenues to get people kind of giving, or to participate in their community somehow. And it doesn't have to be, albeit of course you gotta recognize, you can't not recognize the privilege you might have if you have even a door to lock at night and a room to sleep in, compared to somebody who's out on the elements. But it doesn't have to be all, you know, somber piano music and here's the number screen, absolutely, don't it? Because I don't think that's the way we respond to these things. I think it's important to sort of have that avenue.
I think sometimes as well, it's like you, if you just remind people why you're doing it, they almost want to, like, dare I say it, they want to support me. It's not necessarily a case of going, I'm donating this because I want to give some money necessarily to Turning Tide or to Street Vet. They go, oh, I want to give some money. And that's kind of, again, something that I've learned to do with my kind of fundraising drives and my fundraising posts. So I do these kind of like, I have these stupid ideas, you know, like when I'm just driving around and I go, oh, that sounds like a good idea. Why don't I just stay up for 24 hours and see how many portraits I can draw? Or why don't I draw 100 portraits without resting and it took me 27 hours or something stupid? And I do these like fundraising drives, which are like that kind of comic relief-y type thing, you know, I'm in front of you now for 24 hours and you can check in and donate and everything else. And they've been really successful. At the start of it, the fundraising posts I did, which was just kind of almost like reminding people that I'm fundraising, they were quite successful. The way I kind of try to frame it now with people is I call it my virtual busker's hat, you know? So I kind of just say to people, like, if what I'm doing is entertaining you, if my posts have made you smile for the last 2-3 weeks, whatever it might be, here's my virtual busker's hat, and stick a couple of quid in the pot. And I've kind of realized that works quite well. You don't necessarily have to be, like you say, Josh, you don't have to be like sob story, somber music, I'm raising money for homeless people. You could literally just go, if you just like what I'm doing, it doesn't necessarily matter where it's going, but here's my busker's hat, stick a couple of quid in.
I love that.
And that tends to work quite well.
It's amazing. And it really is. It's kind of, you know, we spoke to people on this podcast that, you know, different people doing different things, but, you know, these tools like Facebook, Instagram is really how I started doing what I'm doing. It's like, it's amazing that you can skip the middleman and do that and have that Instagram live and basically televise what you're doing in a way that kind of broadcast in a way. I know this sounds like kind of more mainstream media kind of terms of like, but essentially you're able to just get your in this case, your pet portraits, that'll be a message, the captions, the humor, whatever it may be to draw people in. I just love that is the positive kind of, you know, the positive that I take from these tools we do have is that, like, yeah, you can log on, you can show people what you're doing. People have this direct way of feeling like they have access to what it is you're doing. I love that.
The social media things is a funny thing for me because a lot of people say, oh, I hate social media. So if you hate social media, you're just following the wrong people on social media. It's that simple. Like, all social media is a platform. Forget all the, like, the Zuckerberg, you know, the privacy and all of that kind of stuff. Just as a platform, people that hate social media are just following the wrong things, right? Yeah. Because it is what you decide to put in front of yourself. If you follow, you know, kind of uplifting people like yourself, Josh, and, you know, people that are just doing some good, you can scroll through your social media and go, the world is not a bad place. You know, there's people out there doing some good. For me, the biggest frustration with social media is all of the algorithms and everything else, which I still haven't quite got my head around. But frustratingly is, again, when I spoke earlier about my fundraising posts being the ones that get the most people kind of turning off from what I'm doing, they're also the posts with the lowest reach. Mm-hmm. And so, again, that's really hard to try to work around that and I haven't kind of quite figured that out. And so you can get people that have been following me for, you know, maybe 4 or 5 months and still don't know that I'm fundraising because they don't show the 10 fundraising updates. So again, that's where, like, when you do these bigger events like the, you know, the 24-hour thing or the 100 portrait challenge, and you then suddenly kind of just put yourself in front of people, then suddenly that can have an impact and stuff. So But for me, social media has, well, the project wouldn't have happened without it.
Right.
It wouldn't have done. Mm-hmm. And the same's got to be said for Just Giving. It's it's such an easy platform. It was so easy to set up. And it's so easy to just go to people, here it is. And it's transparent because none of the money comes to me. So you haven't got to worry about any of that kind of stuff. The technology side of it has, for me, it's been a godsend because it just, the project wouldn't exist without it.
Nice one.
And like you said, it's also been a platform for other things because, you know, your alter ego is evolving. And I want to speak a little bit about that alter ego because Hercule van Wolfwinkel is a very, very funny character. And it was also another challenge, I believe, when you hit a milestone that you had some branding done, didn't you?
I did, yeah. I had to get I had to get Hercule van Wolfwinkel signature tattooed on my, can I say arse?
You can.
I've just said arse. I had to. We were at 50,000 and the next target was 25 grand, and I can't even remember how it come about, but it was this thing of like trying to drive donations. And I said, when we get to 75 grand, I'll have my Hercule van Wolfwinkel signature tattooed on my ass. And I, do you know what? I never thought we would, I didn't think we'd get there. You know, like 50,000 was such a huge amount of money. And like my sort of thing is with this has always been like, whenever we get to like a big milestone, it's my character. I always think that's it now. We've hit the peak and it's all going to come crashing down. Right. So I was like, yeah, someone suggested it. I was like, yeah, get to 75 grand and I will, I'll get it tattooed. And then we got to 75 grand and then a few people reminded me and then a mate phoned me up and just went, I booked you in. So I had to go and get it.
Is that your only tattoo? Done.
It's my only tattoo.
That's amazing. And you got it left or right butt cheek? You don't have to show it. I mean, you can.
Do you know what? I think it's on my right, but I don't actually know. I think I don't see it very often. I think every now and then I kind of get out of the shower and I catch a glimpse of it. Like, you stupid idiot.
That's amazing.
I think it's my right cheek. I then had this. My latest thing is when we got to, I forget what the totals were, but I think it was like 125 grand for Turning Tides and maybe 50 grand for Street Vet or something. I said I would I would do a live stream of me singing I Would Do Anything for Love by Meat Loaf. at karaoke, and I've got to that, and I need to organise that's to be done.
Okay. That's amazing. So on Facebook, so it's Hercule Van Wolfwinkel, and that's where to tune in now for Meatloaf coming up
at some point. I'm trying to organise what I'm hoping would be a really good surprise, but it hasn't. What I'm trying to organise hasn't quite come off yet, but that's why there's a delay on it, because I'm hoping I can do something which would be a really good surprise for everybody. But if not, it'll just be me probably. You know, down my local pub.
But that's honestly, but you're from you working as estate agent, as Phil the estate agent, that's not how I'm identifying you. But I mean, you're working as an estate agent, you're doing what you're doing with your life, and like obviously the pet portraits have come in now, lockdown 2020, your old ego has kind of like formed, and you're kind of really finding an identity, not just through kind of, well, the thousands of requests you had, but also just, I suppose, more presence, like you said, like because this thing kind of went viral. How, because that's about, so two years?
Yeah, over just, 2 years just ago. Over 2 years, yeah.
How's your life changed since then? Like, are you still working in the estate?
No, so I gave that up. It's been about 6 months now as a full-time project. And it basically, something had to give. I was working, because the bigger it's got, you know, what basically started out with me just drawing a picture every night and sticking it on Facebook, because I call it the circus. You know what, you must know what it's like the everything else that comes with it, all the stuff behind the scenes that no one even thinks about was just taking up more and more and more time. And so like a 14-hour day was like the norm. Mm-hmm. I would go to work at 8 o'clock in the morning. I'd get in at 6. I'd spend like an hour or so with my boy Sam before he would go to bed at sort of like 7, half 7. And then from 8 o'clock onwards, the Hercule stuff would start. And it would start by doing that night's post on Facebook. And then you've got the emails and the Zoom calls and the projects that you're doing and everything else. And so like a 14-hour day was the norm. When we had bigger stuff going on, like 18-hour days for, you know, maybe 2-3 weeks at a time whilst the project was getting organised. And I kind of knew there was no longevity to that. And that had been in the back of my mind for a while. And then at Christmas, it kind of reached a bit of a sort of peak really. And I just started fundraising for Street Vet, and that had just started getting off the ground, mm-hmm. but I just knew I couldn't carry on. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't do it. And something had to give. And I couldn't, like this, the Hercule project, like it's got my heart and soul, right? And you can't scale that back. Like when you're piling everything you've got into something, you can't then go, oh, well, do you know what? I'm going to lose all the circus part of it, and I'm just going to go back to drawing a portrait every night, because that wouldn't have felt. So basically the decision was at Christmas was either on the 1st of January, just gone, I was going to post my last portrait. And that was going to be it. And I was going to say, thanks very much, guys. It's been great. But I can't keep doing this. And I would have walked away from it and gone back to being Phil the estate agent. Or it was to try to, you know, basically had to try to make the project full time and lose the other thing. So there was a lot of sleepless nights and long conversations with my family. And we took the decision to take the risk, right? Because in a weird way, that's kind of, it's been by just kind of going with the flow that has got us to where we are. And I still don't know whether I've made the right decision, and I don't know whether I ever will, but like since making the decision, if I had have just put my last post on the 1st of January and that had been it, we've raised about another, I don't know, 60 grand for the charity since then. And so weirdly, if it all ends tomorrow, I'll look back on it and go, well, okay, I turned my life upside down for 6 months, but it was worth it. Because what that 60 grand does for the charities and for other people is so worth it. But I'm just going with the flow and seeing what happens and taking each day as it comes and trying not to think about things too much. Because when I think about things, I get into trouble.
I think that's very... important kind of advice for everyone everywhere, basically. You know, I mean, of course we've got to plan ahead, we've got to have goals, we've got to have things, and you know, I don't support, you know, I haven't got a family of my own, but I can only imagine what that's like when you've obviously got people, you know, that you mouths to feed and people around you you're also supporting. But I think that advice, going with the flow, not thinking about it too much, it's really important following that feeling, you know. And clearly you've done that so far, and it's helping a lot of people, it's working out really well.
And I think it's really lovely for your son to watch you take that risk and follow that, like you say, that whole soul piece. We can all go back and be vets, estate agents, hairdressers in salons, that's easy, right? But it's that kind of real rebel courage to just go out and go, yeah, this is the rat race, but this really is, this is making my heart sing for now.
Yeah.
And there's no wrong or right decisions. There's just decisions we make with the knowledge that we have at the time. Right?
Yeah. The hard thing for me, so the big decision for me about taking whether to take the project full time or not was twofold. It was firstly the risk, or actually, do you know what? Again, in hindsight, looking back on it, it was a perceived risk of giving up the day job because it felt secure. But you realise that the rug can get pulled out from underneath you at any point anyway. So there was that perceived risk of giving up something that had been very stable and very secure and, you know, relatively financially rewarding, a 23-year career. Like almost all, I got chucked out of college at 17, and a month later I became an estate agent. Wow. And 23 years later, you're still doing it. And so there was that. But the other risk that I was worried about taking the project full time was what I then realized I had to do was commercialize elements of it. And so that felt risky. And it felt risky, not necessarily as to whether or not those commercializing elements of it would work, but more about the perception of that from the people who are then donating. I had to, that was something that I just had to kind of try to adjust my mindset to, really. And loads of people were saying to me, you just got to
do it.
In fact, you were one of them, Ebony, and I had loads of support, but it was still just that thing. And so I had to be careful about that. But what we've done with commercializing elements of it is that we basically started doing new things which are commercial, and we haven't changed the bit that is the fundraising. You know, the portraits are still free. And I don't want to sort of sound, but I could make a fortune if I just charge people for, you know, I get offers of thousands of pounds from people that want me to draw their pets. And I don't take commissions. And the reasons for that is because primarily that's what drives the fundraising, you know. And secondly, I don't want it to become exclusive. I don't want it to be something that only people that can afford one get one. I love the fact that it's a lottery. I love the fact that everybody's in with the same chance. And, you know, so, but yeah, but those were the two big things that I was worried about.
Yeah. And I can relate to that as well, mate. Like through my own work, like sure. You know, what I do something for nothing, it already says on the tin, like, you know, I mean, how do I as a person continue this work, make any money? So I really struggled at the beginning because I left my job similarly, like as a hairdresser in a salon, you know, knowing how much money I had to pay the rent and whatever else I wanted to do in my life. And like through, you know, you encapsulate it through what you said, when something's got your heart and your soul, in some ways, retrospectively, it's like easy to go, well, yeah, I had no other choice, because like something had grabbed me that I was really passionate about continuing the work that I was doing. So I made the decision to leave my job, worked casual jobs, cafes and different things to fund it at the beginning. And then I started giving talks, and that was the way I was able to sort of monetize or find an arm to what I'm doing, to be able to like keep fuel in my tank to continue doing the work I do. But even the beginning of that, I was like, is this okay? How is this perceived by people? I'm on the end of this email saying, hey, yeah, you know, and then I start talking about, someone's asking what you charge for a speaker's fee. And I'm like, God, is this all right that I'm earning money?
Yeah, it's
like,
awkward. It's, well, awkward.
It's weird, isn't it? Yeah. But then I've really, really got I'm so accepting of that relationship with that now. I've really done a lot of work to get there, but it's actually, I can understand why you sort of feel like, oh, well, there's this thing, but the way you've described it is perfect, because for me anyway, it makes a lot of sense. It's like, well, look, all of this still exists exactly how it exists, but I've just added on this other branch to what I do to make money, to be able to commercialize it in some way, because you have to do that. And I think that's so important.
It is, but it's also the, I think, but one of the problems that you have is that when something is built from charity, which it has been, then there is this, you know, maybe it's a misplaced conception, but it still exists that then everything I do is for the charity, you know? So, so, you know, you get comments from people sort of saying, a good example actually is that, so I'm doing Christmas cards this year. And it's really clear on all the promotional stuff that we've done that 10% of the proceeds, not the profit, 10% of the proceeds, which is actually over 35% of our profit, is going to the charities. Okay. But you then still get the odd comment that people go, oh, I bought the Christmas cards and it's great to think that I donated X amount to the charities. And they're talking about the full retail price. And that then my, you know, I get this kind of knot in the pit of my stomach because I think, you know, Christ, have I kind of misled you somehow, you know, but actually it's really clear as to what is going to the charities and everything else. But I think it's because there's this conception that everything I do is going to charity, and that's where it's quite hard. And I just find that still a little bit difficult. And it's the same with, you know, kind of, and actually what we have commercialized has then generated a huge amount of money for, well, not a huge amount of money for the charity, but money for the charity that they wouldn't have had without the commercial element. So when I do a limited edition print, for instance, 10% of the sales always go to the charity. Sometimes it's been 20% actually. Yeah. And that's money that if I hadn't done that limited edition print, the charities wouldn't have had, because people wouldn't have bought it. But again, you still get the comments. So somebody said, why only 10%? And, you know, and I said to them, well, you know, I don't have to donate anything, right? But I think, unfortunately, when the assumption is that 100% of what you're doing is for the charity, 10% doesn't sound like very much. If somebody is just following an artist that they like on Instagram who suddenly goes, I'm doing a limited edition print and I'm going to donate 10% of everything to the charity, everyone goes, oh, wow, how generous of you.
Yeah,
it's optics, isn't it? It's optics.
And I would say that's something that I was really, really, really nervous about.
I know you were. But you've been incredibly transparent, and with the huge thousands of people that follow you, people only read 10% of what's posted out there, right? So they're going to miss pieces. But you know in your heart you're being integral. And actually the fact that you're doing prints, merchandise, books, everyone's asking, everyone wants it. So you're actually commercializing what people want. They want a piece of it to pop on their wall, to have as a tote bag, to, you know, to give as a stocking filler. You know?
And like I say, hopefully that is then also generating money for the charities that, you know, kind of wasn't there. And again, we spoke about it earlier, like the conversation, you know, hopefully it actually maybe just sparks a conversation as well. You know, somebody goes around someone's house and goes, oh, why have you got that crap picture hanging on your wall?
And you'll be like,
it's a print by this guy I know, and he raises his money, and it maybe starts a bit of a conversation as well. So,
Well, I mean, you're in this middle of this kind of professional pivot. And a lot of our guests have also kind of spoken about this as kind of almost having, I'm not sure I even like the word, but imposter syndrome, that whole, like, you know, you've gone viral so quick, even having the validation of awards and, you know, the Prime Minister and Just Giving and all these other things. How are you edging your way through that? Because so many people want to take these risks and to do more for nothing and to support people. But often it's that kind of, am I the right person to be doing it? How can you help other people who are probably going through similar things as well? I think we're all in this club. We just don't talk about it.
I mean, my imposter syndrome, I don't think will ever go away, because that's kind of, almost everything that I've done in life, I've never thought what I was doing was good enough. And that's not me being dramatic or anything, but weirdly, it's kind of what I've felt so easy then about this project, because the whole point is it's crap and it's really self, you know, kind of, and so it's easy for me to kind of, you know, kind of enter into that, it's not role because it is just me, but, you know, into that world online of I draw these crap pictures and isn't it crap and everybody laughs at it. And so that bit's the really easy bit. It's then when the kind of the, I know it's not really the more serious bit, but then I guess like the accolades come along. That's suddenly when my imposter syndrome goes into overdrive, because I kind of go, well, you know, a little bit like the Just Giving Award thing. It's for me, I'm just drawing stupid pictures of people's pets. And when you're getting recognition for that, when you kind of look at it in the context of that, even just the charities I'm supporting, you know, the hundreds of people that volunteer for Street Vet and Turning Tides and give up their time all the time and go out onto the front line and do the hard shifts in the middle of the night and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. They're the guys that are the sort of the real heroes of all of this. And so that's, you say, that's sort of when my imposter syndrome really kind of kicks in, because it does sort of, it just feels like I'm doing something that's just a bit silly.
Yeah.
You know?
I think it's a good relationship to have with it, though. You know, I mean, yeah, like the more I take life seriously, and that includes the work that I do and all that stuff, the more of a tight grip I have on the whole thing. And I think that that playful relationship with kind of whatever it is that we do in some way, I think it's a healthy one. You know, and it probably is what keeps you kind of doing it with like that same energy that's put out there to people that it started with, you know, that kind of resonates for people.
The thing is, I'm just enjoying myself. So again, that's kind of partly why it sort of feels a little bit like, because I'm having just as much fun with all of this as everyone else. Like at times it's been, you know, again, you know yourself, Josh, and you know, you're involved in charities and stuff. Like when you're involved in fundraising and stuff, and especially for a prolonged period of time, like it takes over your life. And it gets hard at times, you know, you sometimes you feel the weight of it, you know, but that those moments are actually quite fleeting. And in the main, I'm just having so much fun. So again, it kind of like, is it an imposter syndrome? I don't know whether it is quite imposter syndrome as such, but it sort of feels a little bit like you shouldn't be rewarded for having so much fun, you know? But then to go back to the initial question about what would my advice be to other people, I think that my advice would be anybody that's thinking about kind of getting involved in something, like make decisions carefully, but don't overthink them, I think it would be my advice. And if you are kind of going to get involved in something, a little bit as I've just described, is do something you love. Right? Because what you do, Josh, stem from, you know, obviously initially a passion for hairdressing that you took out onto the streets and then found this passion for helping people. And then those two things combined are then this much bigger thing that you, but in the main, you love doing it. And I love doing what I do. If you're going to embark on something like that, if you don't enjoy it, if you don't love it, if it hasn't got your heart and soul, then I would think twice about it. That would be my advice, because otherwise, when it does get a little bit more tricky, it's going to be a lot harder. I can I say when I get the bits I find trickier, that circus. And if I need to, I just dial it back into, I'm going to sit down and draw someone's pet. And I love doing that. And it'll make someone smile. Yeah. If you haven't got that, then I think it would be, it'd be tough.
You've got a thing to come back to reset.
Yeah.
That's why I'm here.
Yeah.
So we ask all our guests on here, because you've all been invited because you encompass Do Something for Nothing. What does that phrase mean to you, and how can other people take that into their lives and use that to give?
For me, I think it comes back to that thing of like us all knowing that all of us are going to need the help of other people. Like, so... for me, it's not necessarily like doing something for nothing in the context of like giving up all of my time and everything else. It's just about that fact of helping people. Do you know what? It's a really hard question to answer, because I think actually you're just one of those people where you either are inclined to do things for other people or you're not. And if you're not, then there's nothing that I'm going to say that's going to change your mind. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's not the answer you're looking for. I don't know. But I'd like to think that I'm just one of those people that if I see someone that needs some help, mm-hmm. then I'll help them. And that can be, again, as I said earlier, from getting a text message off your mate to say, can you come round and help me jumpstart the car? Or seeing somebody in the street that needs a hand with their, you know, taking their suitcase up a flight of stairs, to giving up your career to draw pictures of people's pets to, I guess like from that side of things, I was just not fortunate enough or whatever, but I guess I was just, the project took me to the place where it became on the face of it a lot bigger than just helping that person carry their suitcase up the stairs. But actually the kind of feeling behind it all is still stems from that thing of just helping somebody.
Yeah. Just bringing in presence where you can for people around you when you've got the time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And yeah. And I agree with you, mate. I think there are people who are going to be more inclined to do that and people who might not. But I suppose for me, like with the work I do as well, like this thing, I didn't make it up. Like it's just this inherent part of being human. Like it may look like these words we say on this podcast or like the way I communicate online, like do something for nothing is more just a place to sort of like umbrella some of these things, you know, but it's just this innate part of like, I think being where when you connect back to like what it is, I think in a really natural kind of way to just be here and living this life, it's like you need the support, as you said, of people around you. And the only thing, the only thing I'd say is that I think it's only usually kind of the cultural landscape that might dictate a lot more people kind of not necessarily doing these things, because we live in these bubbles of kind of like, you know, the individual and the self and kind of that obsession with our needs and maybe just our nuclear family and kind of like what that may look like for us. And we end up putting ourselves, you know, in these kind of like, almost fencing ourselves off from the rest of the world. Sometimes the more you have, sometimes the more you can kind of separate yourself from the rest of society. So like, I do think it's like a real fundamental kind of expression of being human, togetherness, sharing, just evolutionary speaking, kind of like we're so much closer to that than we realize, but it's just all this mad stuff and modern society. And it's here and I'm part of it too. You know, I'm staring it down my life. And of course I'm part of this stuff and I enjoy the benefits of that. But you know, these things can act as reminders, right?
Sure.
And that's why the accolades are like, well, don't give it to me, just give it to like our biology and our evolutionary, whatever it is. Cause I sometimes almost put it back to that. I'm just like, I'm just trying to live. And of course I can spearhead this thing. And I do that because I've let go of my relationship enough to go, I can be Josh and I can talk about these things and I can set these little reminders, but I don't own any of this, nor do I want to. I'm just trying to live and hopefully other people are doing their version of that in different places and that's cool.
Yeah. You know? I think to kind of talk about homelessness as well is like, so one of the things that I think with homeless communities is I think the issue of homelessness, you can look at it as this like, really massive problem, you know, not just even national, but global, but everything else. But actually, if you broke it down into just people within their communities, helping other people within their communities, then you can kind of scale back a bigger problem to just people helping those around them. And again, that's the thing, that's the thing to do something for nothing, is it doesn't have to be something big, just help somebody around you. Do something in your community. Don't try to change the world. I guess that's the point I'm making. Don't try to change the world. Just try to change something around you. And then something might spread out from there.
Amen. No, absolutely, that ripple effect. Well, look, Phil, it's been an absolute pleasure. I think the three of us could talk well into the afternoon. You are such a wonderful example of do something for nothing. Your gift is so unique and so joyous and so impactful. So I'm just so glad that through this Conduit podcast, even more people who may not have heard of you can go and find you. So where can people find a little bit more about you on the interwebs?
The best place, I know a lot of people don't like Facebook, but the best place is Facebook, and it's Pet Portraits by Hercule.
It's Pet Portraits, right?
And then I think on Instagram, it's just Portraits by Hercule.
And your website?
And then the website, which is HerculeVanWolfWinkle.co.uk. But Facebook is Facebook's where I'm probably most active. It's the biggest audience, and cool. and that's where I'm probably most active. But yeah, Pet Portraits by Hercule, or on Instagram, just Portraits by Hercule. Not that I do different pictures on Instagram. It's just how it was.
Nice one, Phil. Cheers, mate.
No really worries. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode of Conduit Conversations. If you enjoyed it, then please support and subscribe to the podcast. To learn more about my work, then please visit www.dosomethingfornothing.org or Instagram at dosomethingfornothing and at Joshua Coombs. If you're feeling inspired, then please use the hashtag dosomethingfornothing or hashtag conduitdsfn.